This is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, during the year 2022, have brought you the surprisingly long history of the name Tiffany, the surprisingly short history of Fiona. We considered the lexicons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Golden Age detective fiction. We met the protest vote rhinoceros, and there was a quiz all about animal etymologies, and a tranquillusionist about Australia's big things. We dug into the terms rainbow washing and queerbaiting and bork, and we went deep into the multilingual warning message inside a Kinder Surprise egg. And now, I've been saving things up all year, and now it's time to smash open the piggy bank to play the annual parade of bonus bits. These are the interesting things this year's interviewees said that I didn't include because their episode was already too long or on a different topic, but now, here they are. Content note, there are some allusions to bawdy talk, and there is one category A swear. There are discussions of mental health, and there's a brief reference to parental violence. On with the show. On the in-character episode, Jing Tzu talked about how Chinese writing systems dealt with the challenges of new technologies like telegraphy having been designed for European writing systems. One of the things Jing Tzu mentions in her book Kingdom of Characters is Nu Shu, a writing system used only by women in one region of the province of Hunan.
Nu Shu is basically women's script, and it's developed kind of like an informal writing for women who otherwise had no access to education in a society, traditional society. My favorite thing about that script is it's slenderer. It's thinner than what you see a character, but these are these individual markings, and there's a lot of crisscrossing patterns. And it's because they're used to approximate patterns that women see when they do embroidery. So it's this incredible relationship or reflection on their social condition that's reflected back in the very writing system that they build for themselves.
In the in-character episode, Jing Tzu talked about how Chinese language contains many homophones, and how these present a lot of difficulty to anyone trying to transcribe Chinese into the Roman alphabet. But a currently very handy function of homophones is that they can be used to say things that would otherwise be censored. Ingenious.
Yes. Yeah, isn't it? There's so many inventions in Chinese culture and linguistic context. Some of it really is impossible to translate. But it's true. Homophones is a fabulous way of saying what you're not supposed to say. For instance, there's the larger rubric for describing these kind of internet anti-authoritarian or evasive slangs is actually called a caonima, which is actually a grass mud horse.
Of course.
Now, yes, but those three put together is actually to approximate the homophones for screw your mother. So it's not coincidental that is used to describe, what would you call it? Like kind of underground use of Chinese characters. Yeah, to escape authoritarian control.
Incredible.
Language games almost like instinctive for any Chinese speaker. There's just endless wordplays in Chinese language. It's quite remarkable.
Marenike Giwe Anaiwu appeared on the episode about moving away from the term Asperger's syndrome, and we discussed the vocabulary around autism. I asked her how she feels about the term neurodiversity.
My thoughts on this are evolving. Initially, before maybe a couple of years ago, I would have said that it's a term that I love and I think is important. And I do use it quite a bit. Neurodiversity is a term that was really meaningful to me when I first learned of it. And it's similarity to biodiversity. And I feel like there's a lot of really profound concepts within it. But I do understand that there's nuances and there's complexities. And I have noticed that it's been co-opted. To a lot of people, it's another code word for autism or autism and ADHD. It's so much more than that. Like, neurodiversity is a fact of life. No human beings have the same brain. And, you know, neurodiversity overall, collectively, includes those with more neurotypical presentations or non-autistic, non-ADHD, non-dyslexic, you know, what have you. You know, Judy Singer created neurodiversity, and she has kind of clarified what she meant versus what it's kind of come to mean colloquially.
Australian sociologist Judy Singer came up with the term neurodiversity in her thesis published in 1998, Judy Singer offered neurodiversity as a term for a civil rights movement. Neurodiversity is not supposed to be a diagnosis, it's meant to be a term to analyse inequality and abuse, and a term for activism for people who are marginalised on grounds of neurology. She has also used biodiversity as a comparison, explaining, "Diversity is a measurement of the degree of variability of a given variable in a given population or place. It is not a characteristic of the individuals in that population."
And I also don't like that neurodiversity has come to mean, oh, this is a buzzword that I can use so I can throw it on top of an employment program or put some colorful brains or try to get some programmers. In some cases, when people are talking about neurodiversity, they expect it to present a particular way. It can be used for exclusion, even though that's not at all what it's intended to be used for. I've seen neurodiversity type of language or affirming language for people to describe things that are, you know, like segregated work shelters and housing and programs. And so it's very tricky using language that's supposed to be liberatory to convey a meaning that's anything but.
That happens an awful lot.
Unfortunately, yeah.
And also just these euphemisms where
it's
not like anything under the surface has changed. People haven't adjusted their language because they have considered how accommodations can be made for different people's needs.
Yeah, they're just, oh, I'm supposed to say this now. Okay, like, you know, it's just a substitution. It's not even really a paradigm shift for a lot of people at all. And that's sad.
Are there any other terms you'd like people to add to their vocabularies for talking about autism?
Sure, and they might already have them. There's the term allistic, which means non-autistic. Years ago when I first heard that, I was like, that just sounds so ridiculous. But the reason why, so I might use allistic or non-autistic, but what I don't want people to do is people have started to use neurotypical to mean non-autistic. And that is not true. A person might be non-autistic, but they could have dyscalculia or they could whatever, you know, so like that's not, they're not necessarily quote unquote neurotypical.
Well, who decided typical?
Exactly.
The committee.
Exactly. So I feel like people should be more precise in what they mean. And I also prefer for people to use descriptive terms as opposed to functioning labels. You know, profound autism, severe autism, mild autism, high functioning, low functioning, anything that's going to make a person feel bad. Like, what's the opposite of high? It's low. Who wants to be low? It's just, I think that people should describe things in a way to where you know what's happening and you're not going to be made to feel any particular way, elevated or lowered.
Speaking of neuro, here's the word's etymology with Tim Clare, who appeared on the Coward episode.
I've just learned the etymology of neuro. It came from the Greek nerve, but before that was sinew, but also a sinew as in like a bowstring or an instrument string or a penis.
Those seem like quite radically different things, a bowstring and a penis, I like to think.
One hopes.
Tim and I discuss some other brain etymology, like hippocampus.
Oh gosh, I love that word. And the brain's quite a tricky one because you'll get lots of hypo, like you'll get the hypothalamus. Now that, of course, means under. That's the other term. And so I often call it the hypothalamus, but it's the hypothalamus, meaning under the thalamus. But hippocampus, meaning horse, is because it looks like a seahorse, right? So don't look at them. They look absolutely terrifying.
I've never seen a hippocampus, so I don't know.
Oh my good, there is a real David Cronenberg like element to them.
Oh no.
I guess the hippocampus came first. So much of the brain is kind of lovely. Because just the first time someone took that piece of the brain out, they thought, this looks a bit like a belt or a girdle. I'm going to name this after the belt. This looks a bit like a seahorse. I'm going to call it the hippocampus. The amygdala from amygdalon, meaning almond. I suppose it's almond-shaped.
Amygdala was also the Latin for tonsil, and other languages still call tonsils almonds.
Really? Wow, I guess they are like almonds as well.
Yeah, everything looking like almonds. I suppose it is quite a general shape.
Yeah.
In the episode Coward, Tim Clare and I talked about the origins of the terms anxiety, angst, cowardice, and I brought up the etymology of worry.
It was originally strangle or kill by biting the throat, which we kind of have as still like dogs worrying cattle. And it was only relatively late in the 1800s that it meant to trouble someone or for someone to feel troubled.
We still have that sense of worrying as being a kind of gnawing or a terrier worrying at a rat's throat or something like that. And it's a lovely metaphor, isn't it? Because it speaks so much to what we do when we worry, which is to gnaw at a problem over and over, to try and wear it down. And the sense that worrying is an active process, that it's still a verb. Anxiety is a state, isn't it? Or a diagnosis or a condition. Worrying is active. And there's often built into that this implication that if I just worry at this enough, I might solve it. I might be able to fix the problem. I might be able to find a new solution.
It's an expression of care in some cases.
Yes. Yes. And yet, I think there's also that violence tied up in it as well. And I don't mean I worry about my daughter, so I'm not meaning to malign people who worry about their children. I worry about all the people I love. I worry about the future of the world. But there's something, I think, destructive about it as well. There's something harmful. There's something painful. There's something bloody. The etymology of it implies how I feel about it, that it's ultimately a futile and painful and destructive process.
Stephanie Fu came on the show to talk about complex post-traumatic stress disorder. This year she published a book, What My Bones Know, in which she recounts the experiences she had had in being diagnosed and treated for the condition. There was one therapist with whom Stephanie had a breakthrough.
You talk about working with a therapist where after you've had your sessions in person, you studied the transcripts. What was it about seeing the words written down that helped you more than just speaking with the therapist?
I was sort of able to dissociate. Look, I don't think everyone could be able to do this, but I'm very used to looking at a Google Doc and editing it. So being able to have it on the page, it was like, first of all, I couldn't argue with it. Right. I couldn't say like, no, I wasn't triggered right then. No, you're misinterpreting it. It's right there. Like, I have the recording. I have the transcript. I did it. There's no getting around it. Number two, yeah, I was sort of able to shift from, oh my God, you're criticizing me mode into like, we're editing this together mode. Here we are in front of the script. We want it to be the best we can. And let's just like make little notes everywhere. And my therapist was also great at just making me feel really safe and cared for. And he built a really safe environment where if there was somewhere in the session where I was like, I highlighted it and I was like, you're being kind of a dick here. He'd be like, oh, absolutely. And he would do that himself. He would be like, look, I'm pushing you way too hard here. Like, this is not okay. He was the first to criticize himself and really look at his own failings and conversation, but as well as saying like, hey, what's going on with you here? You're ranting on and on about nothing. And I would notice it too. I'm like, you can see it on the page. Like, why is there half of a page or two pages of me ranting about nothing? And then we would scroll up. And right before this long rant, I was like talking about my mom holding a knife to my throat. And I was like, uh-huh, I see. He's like, yeah, you dissociated in order to tell this story and you disappeared. And you just got lost on the way because you were dissociated. You weren't in your body. You weren't really conscious of what you were talking about. I was like, yeah, that's very real. And it didn't make me feel like I was, that was my fault, you know, like it was a broken thing to do. It just helped me understand. I see why I did that. I understand it. Like, I can go back and engage with that differently next time, maybe. If I start to feel myself talking for a long time, just take a step back, question, like, hey, might I be triggered right now? Maybe I need to slow down.
In the objectivity episode, Lewis Raven Wallace talked about what objectivity is supposed to mean and what it tends to mean in practice and the failings of the concept.
When you were working in public media, were there words or constructions that you were supposed to avoid in the interests of so-called objectivity?
Oh, there were so many words and constructions. I remember early in my first year, I referred to a source as anti-gay. I would still refer to that source as anti-gay. If I were asked today, it was like a conservative activist of some kind who was advocating pretty fiercely against queer and trans children having rights. But the word anti-gay, my editor was like, that seems biased. It seems like you're expressing an opinion about that person's opinions. I know, mind blown. I can't remember now what we changed it to, but it was like, instead of saying an anti-gay activist, it was like an activist who opposes gay marriage or something like that.
Well, that's a lot of words.
So like these, also these clunky, ungraceful ways that we try to avoid terminology that might seem biased from some perspective. So I was just very confused by that. I think more recently there have been more pronounced and prominent examples of that kind of weird censorship, like not being able to call Donald Trump a racist or not being able to call white supremacist activists white supremacists. The whole debate over how to refer to undocumented immigrants is one that definitely has played out in many newsrooms, that editors have said, oh, well, undocumented is a sort of activist terminology. That's what they want to be called, but we're going to continue to refer to them as illegal, which of course, calling a person illegal has a ton of implicit bias in it as to what you think about that person's actions that they took to survive. And undocumented as terminology was, you know, proposed to push back against that and to reduce the amount of bias against undocumented immigrants in the way that they're perceived and the way that their stories and reasons for being in this country are perceived.
Hear more about the language used for migration in the Away Team episode of the show from a few years ago. On the topic of bias and objectivity, or impossibility thereof, here's historian Charlotte Lydia Riley, who appeared in the Emergency episode about the Malayan Emergency, the 12-year military conflict that Britain refused to call a war.
There's no objective historian. All historians are subjective. Even if you're writing about the Tudors or ancient Greece, there's no objective historian, right?
Yeah. I think there is often a presumption that the recording of history is neutral. And of course it isn't. And the terminology isn't. It's very loaded.
Absolutely. And what's happening now, actually, is that historians like me and other historians who are being critical of empire say we are being accused of subjectivity against what is assumed to be an objective historical record. So we're accused of being politically motivated. We're accused of being in hoc to the values of our time. We're accused of being motivated by our own beliefs and feelings about empire, as if that wasn't also the case for the people who originally wrote these histories. And as if that wasn't the case for the people who want to defend empire as well, the people who are defensive of the sort of very traditional historical record about empire are just as subjective as we are. But it's become a way for them to really criticise this rewriting, and much more, actually, when it's aimed at people of colour and historians of colour. They are always being told they can't possibly be objective about this, or they are definitely politically motivated, or they're motivated by their own experiences, as if all historians weren't, as if everyone wasn't in the same boat. And look, it's not just a kind of culture warsy thing that's coming from ordinary people. It's actually government ministers are telling people that they're doing the wrong sort of history. Education secretary stood up at a Conservative conference this year and said that people were teaching anti-British history in schools and universities, which is sort of funny and sort of is probably going to get someone killed.
It seems really terrible.
It does really feel like this has really happened recently. At the start of my career, it was hard to get anyone interested in empire, and I haven't been a historian for that long. and it was difficult to get people to take the British Empire seriously or to think about it really at all. It was all the Second World War and the Tudors. Yep. And now empire is everywhere, and it is something that has become hugely emotionalized, and all history is political, but this has become a real political football. And it is interesting, because I think there was a lot of kind of gentle critique of empire happening for quite a long time, and now it's very difficult to get that stuff written down. I mean, you have things like the History Reclaimed Project. They're kind of fighting against this idea of sort of political correctness or whatever, and they want people to send in examples of things like museum exhibits and statues and events that have been tempered or had extra description added or been kind of worked on by historians to make them more critical of imperialism. So even retain and explain, which is supposedly the government policy on imperialism, even that's now coming under criticism. They're not actually that keen on the explaining element of
I think it'd be very hard for them to do that and get the other things to hold up. That's the trouble with the truth.
Yeah,
it looks bad.
When it was bad, it is bad, right? It's quite difficult to find yourself constantly labelled anti-British when actually what you're doing is just writing quite banal things that happened. You can get labelled anti-British as a historian, really, for not being particularly critical. You actually don't have to be that out there to be seen as a kind of anti-British activist.
Ah, the fragility.
Mm-hmm.
It seems also a bit inconsistent that, well, maybe it's because, like, you've got several generations of people now who were too young to have lived through the times when a lot of these conflicts were happening, but also weren't educated about them because, like, at school history, we weren't taught about anything that recent. And then the empire is just like this kind of thing where you can have a mindset that it's sort of in the past or was gently a good thing. And then you get quite animated about preserving it against criticism and whatnot.
It is quite strange. It's funny to think about it in tandem with the Second World War, actually, because a lot of people talk about the Second World War as if they were there. And the number of people in Britain who have any direct experience of the Second World War is vanishingly small now, actually. Yeah. It was such a long time ago. But because I think we kind of got frozen in time as a moment that the Second World War was kind of a generation ago.
Yeah.
And we've continued that feeling that it's about a generation ago, right? So we still talk about it as if our grandparents, or as if people who are grandparents today were involved in the war, fought in the war. You know, my grandparents did fight in the war and my grandparents are no longer with us. We're getting to the point now, actually, where there's not very much actual memory, folk memory of the war. So that's something that we think of as being very recent. That's not very recent. Whereas the empire is something that we think about as happened a long time ago, so long ago. Why are you dragging up the past? Whereas actually, many of these countries, India and Pakistan and Bangladesh, became independent in the late 1940s. Most of Britain's African colonies and in the Caribbean become independent in the mid-1960s. Still very much within living memory. There are still quite a lot of people alive in Britain whose family have history within the empire. They themselves do, or it's only a generation back. And it's interesting, I think, the way we talk about the two things, that the empire is something that happened so long ago that if you try to talk about it now, you're just dragging up the past. And the Second World War is something which apparently happened so recently that you can't, as a historian, ever criticise people's interpretations of it or talk about correcting historical record because it happened so recently. And it is a sort of interesting disconnect. And it's a kind of soft British patriotism, which is completely unthinkingly uncritical of imperialism. And remembers empire as a sort of Victorian aesthetic.
Yeah.
Doesn't remember it as a 1940s, 1950s, 1960s aesthetic.
I wonder what most people's boundary is for news events becoming history. Because it's sort of theoretically immediate.
It's funny because I think from a historian's perspective, it's to do with... Well, actually, from a historian's perspective, it's to do with the skills and the tools that you use to think about it. It's not to do with distance. It's not to do with timing. Historians, I think about history because we think about ourselves as people who use particular tools and particular skills and we have particular ways of engaging with the past. And we can do that about something that happened last year.
I guess the theme of this bonus compilation is thoughts and feelings. Although maybe that's the subtextual theme of absolutely everything, and therefore it's not particularly remarkable that the next section is about those things too. Hannah McGregor appeared on the episode Sentiment, talking about sentimentality in literature, and we got to talking about Louisa May Alcott's novel Little Women, wherein the four March sisters live with their saintly mommy while father is away being an army chaplain during the American Civil War.
In the book, it is considered far more integrity-laced to write what you know and with real emotions, but in reality, Louisa May Alcott was doing that to make money because she much preferred writing swashbuckling genre fiction.
She sure did.
Good for her.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great example of a version of a common genre form that has endured specifically because it was actually really messing with the genre at the time. This is a constant challenge for literary scholars that a lot of the texts that endure are actually the outliers, and that we actually spend very little time talking or thinking about books that were the mainstream in their historical moment. But it was absolutely this weirdo lesbian being told by her publisher, there's a lot of money in girls' fiction, and her being like, okay, fine, I'm a working writer, I'll write some girls' fiction, here's some girls' fiction. And also just refusing to play the game a little bit. One of my favorite bits of that, we have actual quotes from her saying that, you know, she published the book in two parts. And for the second part, everybody wanted Joe to end up with Lori, because that's the conclusion of the sentimental arc. And because Joe was based on her, she was like, no, Joe isn't going to end up with anybody. Joe wants to be a writer. And if you're going to be a woman and a writer, you can't get married because there's no space for your career if you're running a household. But her publisher was like, no, Joe has to get married. Otherwise, people will be wildly dissatisfied. And she was like, fine, you want Joe to get married? She's going to marry a weird old German guy.
I'll show you wild dissatisfaction. It's everyone's marriage in this book.
And Lori's going to marry her horrible little sister. Yeah, yeah. It's a real fuck you to the expectations.
Still feel a bit sore about how all that turned out. And they're going to set up a boys' school. How empowering.
I think it's such an interesting example of somebody who is so obviously bucking against the restrictions of what they can say in their moment. There are these genre expectations being forced upon her, and there's her very practical desire to write a book that will make her money. And then there's that attempt to just, you know, sneak in something that sort of just says no to all of those expectations.
When you were describing the tropes of sentimental fiction of the 19th century, the other example that I thought of was What Katie Did,
mm-hmm.
where you've got, bit similar to Joe and Little Women, a sassy, naughty female lead. But then she is kind of fully converted into the sentimental with a spinal injury and the counsel of her beatific disabled cousin.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I mean, that is an important part of the sentimental education that a lot of these girls undergo, right? That Joe becomes better because of Beth's illness. You sort of encounter this perfect paragon of sentimentality who has to be dying, because there is nothing more perfect that a woman can do than die. Truly the purest the purest way for us to exist is to die. And we still see this, you know, up to the present day, like repeated in contemporary culture. The dead wife is the perfect wife.
Except in Rebecca.
That's why Rebecca's an interesting gothic. The gothic, the dead wife is a sinister presence. In the sentimental, the dead wife is the perfect wife. There's a really interesting trend in scholarship recently about sentimental novels, pointing out that while the goal of the sentimental narrative is the emotional maturity of our heroine, the story becomes deeply boring the second she becomes mature, because the emotionally mature heroine doesn't do anything. And so we spend a lot of time in the childhood. We dwell in the childhood because that's when the narrative is interesting. That's when she can actually go out and do things. But she's got to become a marmy at some point. Otherwise, she has not sort of reached her conclusion.
Marmy or death. That's it. Her conclusion. What's it they say in Never Let Me Go? Completed.
Yes. Yes, exactly. There's two ways that a woman can become completed. And that is that she either becomes a marmy or dies.
Either way, desexualized, a life lived in sacrifice and deference to others.
Yes. Yes. All of the above.
Anger. Present but contained.
Yeah. Yeah. And within this sort of imagination of what is possible for women, we then have to have like institutions and systems that punish or manage women who refuse to fit into those molds, right? So we've got hatred of the spinster, the suspicion of the spinster. We've got the long history of institutionalizing women for hysteria because they refuse to fit into these molds. So we've got ways of managing all of these unruly bodies that aren't willing to either die or become a marmy.
Jolenta Greenberg and Kristin Meinzer talked on the self-help episode about the things they've learned from living by various self-help books on their podcast, By the Book. I asked them what they think about the term life hack, which came out of hack being used in computing as a solution that might be a little unorthodox and perhaps cruder than usual, but probably quicker, like chainsawing a path directly to the centre of the hedge maze. Life hack
is attributed to technology writer Danny O'Rourke in 2004, he meant it to denote the kinds of little bits of script that programmers would write to make their daily lives easier, programs to help them remember household chores or loved ones' birthdays. Whereas now, life hack will mean things like turning toilet rolls into all kinds of storage or decorative items, or making mashed potato out of crisps, which seems more hassle than mashing a potato to me. And a lot of the life hacks are just fairly standard tips. So why do they get called life hacks?
I think it's a way to get men to read self-help books. and it's also, you know, the language of a lot of social media too. Just like, oh, we don't want to actually have to work for this, but watch this 30-second TikTok video to find a hack for this. There's a lot of, you know, let's do it quickly. Let's have it sound masculine. When I think of a hack, I think of like a machete.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like a hacksaw.
Yeah, this has got to be tough. This has got to be quick. This has got to be violent. And it's going to pay off. That's what I think of when I think of hacks. And I also think that very rarely is a hack life-changing. If it's something that only is a 10-second difference in my life, or a 30-second thing that I have to do differently, I don't usually find that transforms my entire life.
Yeah.
Damn it. It does feel like transformation is only 30 seconds of video consumption away, and yet remains just beyond our grasp.
Shocking, I know.
Also, the life hacks are often just doing things in a way you can do things right. That is neither better nor...
It's I was like, going to say, sometimes it's just, yeah, how to like more easily separate the egg white from the yolk. That's just like another way of doing something. And it's just a like buzzy way of being like, here's a way to do it.
Here's another technique in the kitchen.
Yeah, technique. Yeah. Thank you. Instead, we say life hack.
Yeah, I just want the currency of that term to fully dwindle.
Hopefully it is. It's gotta be.
Since Jolenta and Kristin are mavens of concerted self-improvement, I asked them about New Year's resolutions. Tis the season.
I've definitely not made any resolutions since we've been making by the book, because living by self-help books is like making a new resolution every time you sort of sign up for one.
That's intense.
So I've sort of let myself off the hook when it comes to the actual New Year's resolution.
Yeah, I don't really need New Year's resolutions.
See how happy and well-adjusted she is? I'm good.
No, not because I'm happy and well-adjusted, but New Year's resolutions just, they seem so fraught. And the whole idea of new year, new you, like what's bad with old me? You know? And so many people, they just fail at their New Year's resolutions. It's just because most people aren't clear and specific and attainable when it comes to their goals. And so a lot of them also just feel very punitive. Very few people are making resolutions that sound fun.
Right, right.
Why don't we make resolutions that aren't really about punishing ourselves?
That aren't about like cutting out sugar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why don't you add something?
Yeah.
Like a goal I came up with was mid-year this year. I'm like, I'm going to listen to celebrity memoirs while I walk and just see how many I can get through. And see, that's my kind of resolution. It's like, it's not necessarily at New Year's. And it's like, this is a fun thing to do. I'm resolving to do something kind of fun this year, you know?
I've made two in adult life that have really stuck. One was to keep a spreadsheet of every book I finished, which was to get myself reading more. Mm. I've been keeping it for 12 years. And the other was not to click on any Daily Mail links. And both of those have gone great.
Whoa,
I love that second one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tremendous.
Yes, love it. Love it.
Both these resolutions of mine have been going strong for more than a decade. The resolution I made at the start of this year was to spend more time with Illusionist listeners. And I did. I set up the Illusionverse Discord and we have the live streams and the Illusionist patrons hang out. And it's been really lovely. In my opinion, 10 out of 10 New Year's resolution outcomes. If you would like to join us, you would be ever so welcome. Go to theillusionist.org/donate. Thanks to you for listening to the show this year, and thanks to all of the people who've appeared on it. In this episode, you heard again from Jing Tzu, Marenike Giwa Anairu, Tim Clare, Stephanie Fu, Lewis Raven Wallace, Charlotte Lydia Riley, Hannah McGregor, Kristen Meinzer, and Jolenta Greenberg. I'll link to the episode they were in earlier this year at theillusionist.org/bonus2022.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is washing. That's washing with no G on the end. Washing, noun, aeronautics. An increase in the angle of incidence of an aeroplane wing towards the tip. Try using washing in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Martin Austwick makes the original music for The Illusionist. Hear his compositions via palebirdmusic.com and as Pale Bird on Bandcamp. Our ad partner is Multitude. Thanks to Amanda and Carly for their work on behalf of the show this year. To sponsor an episode in 2023, contact them at multitude.production/ads. This is the last Illusionist episode of 2022. The show will return with new episodes mid-January 2023. And in the meantime, stay in touch by finding Allusionist Show on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter. And you can hear or read every episode, get links to more information about the topics, and donate to the show and join the Allusiverse community. And see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words at the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.